Welcome to A.E. Read Skiffily, the podcast that features science fiction stories read with sound effects. It's like old-timey radio. In this podcast, we tap into the imagination of readers and listeners everywhere. I'm A.E.
I'm Mona.
Hey, Mona. So today's story, the story that Mona and I are going to read today, is 10 to the 16 to 1 by James Patrick Kelly. This story was originally published in the June 1999 issue of Asimov's Science Fiction, and it won the 2000 Hugo Award for Best Novelette. It's actually long enough to be a novelette. It was also more recently reprinted in the December 2013 issue of Clark's World magazine. Clark's World also has a podcast of their stories, and Kate Baker reads this one. So I'll have a link to the Clark's World version in the show notes. You can contrast and compare the two podcast readings if you'd like. But after Mona and I read the story, we will discuss some issues that come about in the story. So put on your listening ears and relax.
And listen.
Yeah.
But the best evidence we have that time travel is not possible and never will be is that we have not been invaded by hordes of tourists from the future. Stephen Hawking, The Future of the Universe.
I remember now how lonely I was when I met Cross. I never let anyone know about it because being alone back then didn't make me quite so unhappy. Besides, I was just a kid. I thought it was my own fault. It looked like I had friends. In 1962, I was on the swim team and got elected assistant patrol leader of the Wolf Patrol in Boy Scout Troop 7. When sides got chosen for kickball at recess, I was usually the fourth or fifth pick. I wasn't the best student in the sixth grade of John Jay Elementary School. That was Betty Garoli. But I was smart and the other kids made me feel bad about it. So I stopped raising my hand when I knew the answer and I watched my vocabulary. I remember I said albeit once in class and they teased me for weeks. Packs of girls would come up to me on the playground.
Hooray!
When I turned around,
albeit!
And then they'd run away, choking with laughter. It wasn't that I wanted to be popular or anything. All I really wanted was a friend. One friend. A friend I didn't have to hide anything from. Then came Cross, and that was the end of that. One of the problems was that we lived so far away from everything. Back then, Westchester County wasn't so suburban. Our house was deep in the woods in tiny Willoughby, New York, at the end of Cobbs Hill Road. In the winter, we could see Long Island Sound, a silver needle on the horizon pointing toward the city. But school was a half-hour drive away, and the nearest kid lived in Ward's Hollow, 3 miles down the road, and he was a dumb fourth grader. So I didn't have any real friends. Instead, I had science fiction. Mom used to complain that I was obsessed. I watched Superman reruns every day after school. On Friday nights, Dad used to let me stay up for Twilight Zone. But that fall, CBS had temporarily canceled it. It came back in January after everything happened, but was never quite the same. On Saturdays, I watched old sci-fi movies on Adventure Theater. My favorites were Forbidden Planet and The Day the Earth Stood Still. I think it was because of the robots. I decided when I grew up, and it was the future, I was gonna buy one so I wouldn't have to be alone anymore. On Monday mornings, I'd get my weekly allowance, a quarter. Usually I'd get off the bus that same afternoon down in Ward's Hollow so I could go to Village Variety. 25 cents bought two comics and a pack of red licorice. I especially loved DC's Green Lantern, Marvel's Fantastic Four, and Incredible Hulk. But I'd buy almost any superhero. I read all through the science fiction books in the library twice, even though Mom kept nagging me to try different things. But what I loved best of all was Galaxy Magazine. Dad had a subscription, and when he was done reading them, he would slip them to me. Mom didn't approve. I always used to read them up in the attic or out in the lean-to I'd lash together in the woods. Afterwards, I'd store them under my bunk in the bomb shelter. I knew that after the nuclear war, there would be no TV or radio or anything, and I'd need something to keep me busy when I wasn't fighting mutants. I was too young in 1962 to understand about Mom's drinking. I could see that she got bright and wobbly at night, but she was always up in the morning to make me a hot breakfast before school. And she would have graham crackers and peanut butter waiting when I came home. Sometimes cinnamon toast. Dad said I shouldn't ask Mom for rides after 5 because she got so tired keeping house for us. He sold Anderson Windows and was away a lot, so I was pretty much stranded most of the time. But he always made a point of being home on the first Tuesday of the month so he could take me to the scout meeting at 7:30. Now, looking back on it, I can't really say that I had an unhappy childhood until I met Cross. I remember it was a warm Saturday afternoon in October. The leaves covering the ground were still crisp, and their scent spiced the air. I was in the lean-to I'd built that spring, mostly to practice the square and diagonal lashings I needed for scouts. I was reading Galaxy. I even remember the story, The Ballad of Lost Camel by Cordwainer Smith. The squirrels must have been chittering for some time, but I was too engrossed by Lord Gesticost's problems to notice. Then I heard a faint, not 10 feet away. I froze, listening. It could have been a dog, except dogs didn't usually slink through the woods. I was hoping it might be a deer. I'd never seen deer in Willoughby before, although I'd heard hunters shooting. I scooted silently across the dirt floor and peered between the dead saplings. At first, I couldn't see anything, which was odd. The woods weren't all that thick, and the leaves had long since dropped from the understory brush. I wondered if I'd imagined the sounds. It wouldn't have been the first time. Then, I heard a twig snap, maybe a foot away. The wall shivered, as if something had brushed against it, but there was nothing there. Nothing. I might have screamed then, except my throat started to close. I heard whatever it was skulk to the front of the lean-to. I watched in horror as an unseen weight pressed an acorn into the soft earth. And then I scrambled back into the farthest corner. That's when I noticed that when I wasn't looking directly at it, the air where the invisible thing should have been shimmered like a mirage. The lashings that held the frame creaked, as if it were bending over to see what it had caught, getting ready to drag me, squealing out into the sun.
Ow! Fuck!
It thrashed away into the woods. In that moment, I was transformed. And I suppose that history too was forever changed. I had somehow scared the thing off. 12-year-old scrawny me. But more important was what it had said. Certainly I was well aware of the existence of the word fuck before then. But I had never dared use it myself. Nor do I remember hearing it spoken by an adult. A spaz like that Murphy kid might say it under his breath. But he hardly counted. I'd always thought of it as language's atomic bomb. Used properly, the word should make brains shrivel, eardrums explode. But when the invisible thing said fuck and then ran away, it betrayed a vulnerability that made me reckless, and more than a little stupid.
Hey, stop!
I took off in pursuit. I didn't have any trouble chasing it. The thing was no Davy Crockett. It was noisy and clumsy and slow. I could see a flickery outline as it lumbered along. I closed to within 20 feet and then had to hold back where I would have caught up to it. I had no idea what to do next. We blundered on in slower and slower motion until finally I just stopped.
Whoa, wait! What do you want?
I put my hands on my waist and bent over like I was trying to catch my breath, although I didn't need to. The thing stopped too, but didn't reply. Instead, it sucked air in, wheezy and ragged. It was harder to see now standing still, but I think it must have turned toward me.
Are you okay?
You are a child.
I'm in the 6th grade.
I straightened, spread my hands in front of me to show that I wasn't a threat.
What's your name?
I took a step toward it and waited. Nothing. But at least it didn't bolt.
I'm Ray Beaumont. I live over there. How come I can't see you?
What is the data?
For a moment, I thought it meant data. Data? I puzzled over an answer. I didn't want it thinking I was just a stupid little kid.
I don't know. October 20th?
The thing considered this.
What is the year?
That took my breath away.
Oh, jeez.
At that point, I wouldn't have been surprised if Rod Serling himself had popped out from behind a tree and started addressing the unseen TV audience, which might have included me, except this was really happening.
Do you know what you just... what it means when...
What? What?
You're invisible and you don't know what year it is? Everyone knows what year it is. Are you... you're not from here.
Yes. Yes, I am. 1962, of course. This is 1962. And I am not invisible. This is only Camu.
Camel?
Now, Camu.
The air in front of me crinkled and slid away from a dark face.
You have no dare to camouflage?
Oh, sure, camo.
I suppose the thing meant to reassure me by showing itself, but the effect was just the opposite. Yes, it had two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. It stripped off the camouflage to reveal a neatly pressed gray three-piece business suit, a white shirt, and a red and blue striped tie. At night, on a crowded street in Manhattan, I might have passed it right by. Dad had taught me not to stare at the kooks in the city. But in the afternoon light, I could see all the things wrong with its disguise. The hair, for example, not exactly a crew cut, it was more of a stubble, like Mr. Rudowski's chin when he was growing his beard. The thing was way too thin, its skin was shiny, its fingers too long, and its face. It looked like one of those Barbie dolls.
Are you a boy or a girl?
It started.
There is something wrong?
I cocked my head to one side.
I think maybe it's your eyes. They're too big or something. Are you wearing makeup?
I am naturally Maella.
He bristled as he stepped out of the camouflage suit.
I do not have gender.
If you say so.
I could see he was gonna need help getting around, only he didn't seem to know it. I was hoping he'd reveal himself, brief me on the mission. I even had an idea how we could contact President Kennedy or whoever he needed to meet with. Mr. Newell, the scoutmaster, used to be a colonel in the army. He would know some general who could call the Pentagon.
What's your name?
He draped the suit over his arm.
Crash.
I waited for the rest of it as he folded the suit in half.
Just Cross?
My given name is Chitman Singh.
He warbled it like he was calling birds.
That's okay. Let's just make it Mr. Cross.
As you wish, Mr. Beaumont.
He folded the suit again. Again. And again.
Hey, how do you do that?
He continued to fold it.
Can I see?
He handed it over. The camo suit was more impossible than it had been when it was invisible. He had reduced it to a 6-inch square card as thin and flexible as the Queen of Spades. I folded it in half myself. The two sides seemed to meld together. It would have fit into my wallet perfectly. I wondered if Cross knew how close I was to running off with his amazing gizmo. He'd never catch me. I could see flashes of my brilliant career as the invisible superhero. Tales to Confound presents The Origin of Camo Kid. I turned the card over and over, trying to figure out how to unfold it again. There was no seam, no latch. How could I use it if I couldn't open it?
Neat.
Reluctantly, I gave the card back to him. Besides, real superheroes didn't steal their powers. I watched Cross slip the card into his vest pocket. I wasn't scared of him. What scared me was that at any minute, he might walk out of my life. I had to find a way to tell him I was on his side. Whatever that was.
So you live around here, Mr. Cross?
I am from the island of Mauritius.
Where's that?
It is in the Indian Ocean, Mr. Baumant, near Madagascar.
I know where Madagascar is. I play Risk with my dad.
Then I couldn't think of what else to say. Finally, I had to blurt out something, anything, to fill the silence.
It's nice here. Real quiet, you know. Private.
Yes. I had not expected to meet anyone.
He, too, seemed at a loss.
I have business in New York City on the 26th of October.
New York? That's a ways away.
Is it? How far would you say?
50 miles, 60 maybe? You have a car?
No, I do not drive, Mr. Baumant. I am to take the train.
The nearest train station was New Canaan, Connecticut. I could have hiked it in maybe half a day. It would be dark in a couple of hours.
If your business isn't until the 26th, you'll need a place to stay.
The plan is to take rooms at a hotel in Manhattan.
That costs money.
He opened a wallet and showed me a wad of crisp new bills. For a minute, I thought they must be counterfeit. I hadn't realized that Ben Franklin's picture was on money. Cross was giving me the goofiest grin. I just knew they'd eat him alive in New York and spit out the bones.
Are you sure you want to stay in a hotel?
Why would I not?
Look, you need a friend, Mr. Cross. Things are different here than on your island. Sometimes people do, you know, bad stuff. Especially in the city.
He nodded and put his wallet away.
I am aware of the dangers, Mr. Baumant. I have trained not to draw attention to myself. I have the proper equipment.
He tapped the pocket where the camo was. I didn't point out to him that all his training and equipment hadn't kept him from being caught out by a 12-year-old.
Sure, okay. It's just, look, I have a place for you to stay if you want. No one will know.
Your parents, Mr. Baumant.
My dad's in Massachusetts until next Friday. He travels. He's in the window business, and my mom won't know.
How can she not know that you have invited a stranger into your house?
Not the house. My dad built us a bomb shelter. You'll be safe there, Mr. Cross. It's the safest place I know. My dad built it back in 1960. 2 years ago, that is. That's when Kennedy beat Nixon. Dad said he was going to start a war, so he built the shelter instead of taking a vacation. It's buried about 150 feet from the house. It's nothing special. Just a little cellar without anything built on top of it.
Ah, that will help avoid detection.
Right. See? Here's the entrance. It's a steel bulkhead.
I remember how Cross seemed to lose interest in me, his mission, and the entire 20th century the moment he entered the shelter.
Ta-da! It's a little cramped. Dad filled it up with all this food and all this equipment, but you can sleep on one of those cots.
Yes, I see.
If you need to wash up, there's a sink and a toilet, if you need it. Gosh, half of this place is filled up with this stuff, isn't it?
Yes.
There aren't any windows, but as long as you don't mind the smell...
The smell?
Yeah, it's kind of a musty smell. You don't notice?
Musty, right.
He sat around all of Sunday, dodging my attempts to draw him out. He seemed... distracted, like he was listening to a conversation I couldn't hear. When he wouldn't talk, we played games. At first it was cards, gin and crazy eights mostly. In the afternoon, I went back to the house and brought over checkers and Monopoly. Despite the fact that he did not seem to be paying much attention, he beat me like a drum. Not one game was even close. But that wasn't what bothered me. I believed that this man had come from the future, and here I was, building hotels on Baltic Avenue. Monday was a school day.
Okay, here's the plan, Mr. Cross. I'm going to lock you in the shelter. I've got my key, and I'm taking Mom's key with me. This is the only way I can be sure she doesn't catch you by surprise.
Actually, I doubted she'd come all the way out to the shelter. She'd stayed away after Dad gave her that first tour. She had about as much use for nuclear war as she had for science fiction. Still, I had no idea what she did during the day while I was gone. I couldn't take chances. Besides, it was a good way to make sure that Cross didn't skin out on me. I thought Cross would object to my plan of locking him in, but he never said a word. When I opened the shelter door after school on that Monday, Cross lay just as I had left him the night before, sprawled across the big cot, staring at nothing. I remember being a little worried. I thought he might be sick. I stood beside him, and still he didn't acknowledge my presence.
Are you all right, Mr. Cross? I brought Risk.
I sat next to him on the bed and nudged him with the corner of the box to wake him up.
Did you eat?
He sat up and took the cover off the game.
Those are the instructions.
Risk is a fascinating game of strategy in which a player can conquer the world. President Kennedy will address the nation this evening at 7 o'clock.
For a moment, I thought he had made a slip.
How do you know that?
The announcement came last night.
I realized that his pronunciation had improved a lot.
I have been studying the radio.
I walked over to the radio on the shelf next to the sink. Dad said we were supposed to leave it unplugged, something about the bombs making a power surge. It was a brand new, solid-state, multiband Heath kit that I'd helped him build. When I pressed the on button, women immediately started singing about shopping.
Do me a favor, okay? Next time when you're done, would you please unplug this? I could get in trouble if you don't.
I stooped to yank the plug. When I stood up, he was holding a sheet of paper.
I will need some things tomorrow, Mr. Beaumont. I would be grateful if you could assist me.
I glanced at the list without comprehension. He must have typed it, only there was no typewriter in the shelter.
To buy one General Electric transistor radio with earplug, one General Electric replacement earplug, two Eveready heavy-duty 9-volt batteries, one New York Times Tuesday, October 23, Rand McNally map of New York City and vicinity, to receive in change $5 in coins, 20 nickels, 10 dimes, 12 quarters.
When I looked up from the typed list, I could feel the change in him. His gaze was electric. It seemed to crackle down my nerves. I could tell that what I did next would matter very much.
I don't get it.
There are inaccuracies.
Look, you'll pay almost double if we buy a transistor radio at Ward's Hollow. I'll have to buy it at Village Variety. Wait a couple of days. We can get one much cheaper down in Stamford.
My need is immediate. I am assured this will cover the expense.
He extended his hand and tucked something into the pocket of my shirt. I was afraid to look. Even though I knew what it was, he'd given me $100 bill. I tried to thrust it back at him, but he stepped away and it spun to the floor between us.
I can't spend that.
You must read your own money, Mr. Beaumont.
He picked the bill up and brought it into the light of the bare bulb on the ceiling.
This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
No, no, you don't understand. A kid like me doesn't walk into a Village Variety with $100. Mr. Radowski will call my mom.
If it is inconvenient for you, I will secure the items myself.
He offered me the money again. If I didn't agree, he'd leave and probably never come back. I was getting mad at him. Everything would be so much easier if only he'd admit what we both knew about who he was. Then I could do whatever he wanted with a clear conscience. Instead, he was keeping all the wrong secrets and acting really weird. It made me feel dirty, like I was helping a pervert.
What's going on?
I do not know how to respond, Mr. Beaumont. You have the list. Read it now and tell me, please, with which item you have a problem.
I snatched the $100 from him and jammed it into my pants pocket.
Why don't you trust me?
He stiffened as if I'd hit him.
I let you stay here. I didn't tell anyone. You have to give me something, Mr. Cross.
He looked uncomfortable.
Well, then, I would ask you to keep the change.
Oh, geez, thanks. Okay. I'll buy the stuff right after school tomorrow.
With that, he seemed to lose interest again. We opened the risk board and he showed me where his island was.
Mr. Beaumont, the island of Mauritius is right here.
Where? There's nothing there.
The island is small. This map does not render its location.
We played 3 games and he crushed me every time. I remember at the end of the last game watching in disbelief as he finished building a wall of invading armies along the shores of North Africa. South America, my last continent, was doomed.
Looks like you win again.
I traded in the last of my cards for new armies and launched a final, useless counterattack. When I was done, he studied the board for a moment.
I think risk is not a proper simulation, Mr. Beaumont. We should both lose for fighting such a war.
That's crazy. Both sides can't lose.
Yet they can. It sometimes happens that the victors envy the dead.
That night was the first time I can remember being bothered by Mom talking back to the TV. I used to talk to the TV too. When Buffalo Bob asked what time it was, I would screech out,
"Howdy doody time!"
Just like every other kid in America.
Oh my God, you're gonna kill us all!
I thought the president looked tired, like Mr. Newell on the third day of a campout.
My fellow citizens, let no one doubt that this is a difficult and dangerous effort on which we have set out. No one.
Despite the fact that it was close to her bedtime and she was shouting at the President of the United States, Mom looked great. She was wearing a shiny black dress and a string of pearls. She always got dressed up at night, whether Dad was home or not. I suppose most kids don't notice how their mothers look, but everyone always said how beautiful Mom was. And since Dad thought so too, I went along with it, as long as she didn't open her mouth. The problem was that a lot of the time, Mom didn't make any sense. When she embarrassed me, it didn't matter how pretty she was. I just wanted to crawl behind the couch.
Mom!
As she leaned toward the television, the martini in her glass came close to slopping over the edge. President Kennedy stayed calm.
The path we have chosen for the present is full of hazards, as all paths are. But it is the one most consistent with our character and courage as a nation and our commitments around the world. The cost of freedom is always high, but Americans have always paid it. And one path we shall never choose, and that is the path of surrender or submission.
Shut up, you foolish man! Stop this! Might,
she shot out of her chair, right, and then some of her drink did spill.
Take it easy, Mom. Don't you understand?
She put the glass down and tore a Kleenex from the box on the end table.
He wants to start World War III.
She dabbed at the front of her dress.
Mom, nobody wants to start World War III.
She ignored me, brushed by, and picked up the phone.
Hello? Oh, thank God.
I could tell from the sound of her voice that it was Dad.
You heard him then?
She bit her lip as she listened to him.
Yes, but... No, I can't, Dave. No. Raimi, turn off that TV.
I hated it when she called me Raimi, so I only turned the sound down.
You have to come home now, Dave. No, you listen to me. Can't you see? The man's obsessed. Just because he has a grudge against Castro doesn't mean he's allowed to...
With the sound off, Chet Huntley looked as if he were speaking at his own funeral.
I'm not going in there without you.
I think Dad must have been shouting because Mom held the receiver away from her ear. Watching her face made me sorry I was in the 6th grade. Better to be a stupid little kid again who thought grown-ups knew everything. I wondered whether Cross had heard the speech.
And neither is Raimi. He'll stay with me.
I bounced off the couch.
Let me talk to him.
The look she gave me stopped me dead.
What for? No, we are going to finish this conversation, David. Do you hear me? Okay, all right. But don't you dare hang up.
She waved me over and slapped the phone into my hand as if I had put the missiles in Cuba. She stalked to the kitchen. I needed a grown-up so bad that I almost cried when I heard Dad's voice.
Ray, your mother is pretty upset.
Yes.
I want to come home. I will come home. But I can't just yet. If I just up and leave and this blows over, I'll get fired.
But Dad...
You're in charge until I get there. Understand, son? If the time comes, everything is up to you.
Yes, sir.
I'd heard what he didn't say. It wasn't up to her.
I want you to go out to the shelter tonight. Wait until she goes to sleep. Top off the water drums, get all the gas out of the garage, and store it next to the generator. But here's the most important thing. You know the sacks of rice? Drag them off to one side. The pallet, too. There's a hatch underneath. The key to the airlock door unlocks it. You've got 2 new guns and plenty of ammunition. The revolver is a .357 Magnum. You be careful with that, Ray. It can blow a hole in a car, but it's hard to aim. The double-barreled shotgun is easy to aim, but you have to be close to do any harm. And I want you to bring down the Game Master from my closet. And the .38 for my dresser drawer.
He'd been talking as if there would be no tomorrow.
Now this is all just in case, okay? I just want you to know.
I had never been so scared in my life.
Ray?
I should have told him about Cross then, but Mom weaved into the room.
Got it, Dad. Here she is.
Mom smiled at me. It was a lopsided smile that was trying to be brave, but wasn't doing a very good job of it. She had a new glass, and it was full. She held out her hand for the phone, and I gave it to her. I remember waiting until almost 10 o'clock that night, reading under the covers with a flashlight. The Fantastic Four invaded Latveria to defeat Dr. Doom. Superman tricked Mr. Mixiel Spitlick into saying his name backwards once again. When I opened the door to my parents' bedroom, I could hear Mom snoring. It spooked me. I hadn't realized that women did that. I thought about sneaking in to get the guns, but decided to take care of them tomorrow. I stole out to the shelter, turned my key in the lock, and pulled on the bulkhead door. It didn't move. That didn't make any sense, so I gave it a hard yank. The steel door rattled terribly, but it did not swing away. The air had turned frosty, and the sound carried in the cold. I held my breath, listening to my blood pound. The house stayed dark, the shelter quiet as stones. After a few moments, I tried one last time before I admitted to myself what had happened. Cross had bolted the door shut from the inside. I went back to my room, but couldn't sleep. I kept going to the window to watch the sky over New York, waiting for a flash of killing light. I was all but convinced that the city would burn that very night in thermonuclear fire, and that Mom and I would die horrible deaths soon after, pounding on the unyielding steel doors of our shelter. Dad had left me in charge, and I had let him down. I didn't understand why Cross had locked us out. If he knew that a nuclear war was about to start, he might want our shelter all to himself. But that made him a monster, and I still didn't see him as a monster. I tried to tell myself that he'd been asleep and couldn't hear me at the door. But that couldn't be right. What if he'd come to prevent the war? He'd said he had business in the city on Thursday. He could be doing something really, really futuristic in there, and he couldn't let me see. Or else he was having problems. Maybe our 20th century germs had got to him, like they killed H.G. Wells' Martians. I must have teased 100 different ideas apart that night, in between uneasy trips to the window and glimpses at the clock. The last time I remember seeing was 4:16. I tried to stay up to face the end, but I couldn't. I wasn't dead when I woke up the next morning, so I had to go to school. Mom had cream of wheat all ready when I dragged myself to the table. Although she was all bright and bubbly, I could feel her giving me the mother's eye when I wasn't looking. She always knew when something was wrong. I tried not to show her anything. There was no time to sneak out to the shelter. I barely had time to finish eating before she bundled me off to the bus. Right after the morning bell, Miss Tui had us read to ourselves.
All right, class. Open up the story of New York State to Chapter 7, Resources and Products. You have 20 minutes. Read quietly, quietly, to yourselves, and we'll discuss.
Then she left the room. We looked at each other in amazement. I heard Bobby Conniff whisper something. It was probably dirty. A few kids snickered. Chapter 7 started with a map of product symbols. Two teeny little cows grazed near Binghamton. Rochester was a cog, and a pair of glasses. Elmira was an adding machine, Oswego an apple. There was a lightning bolt over Niagara Falls. Dad had promised to take us there someday. I had the sick feeling that we'd never get the chance. Miss Tui looked pale when she came back, but that didn't stop her from giving us a spelling test. I got a 95. The word I spelled wrong was enigma. The hot lunch was American chop suey, a roll, a salad, and a bowl of butterscotch pudding. In the afternoon, we did decimals. Nobody said anything about the end of the world. I decided to get off the bus in Ward's Hollow, buy the stuff Cross wanted, and pretend I didn't know he had locked the shelter door last night. If he said something about it, I'd act surprised. If he didn't, I didn't know what I'd do then. Village Variety was next to Warren's Esso and across the street from the post office. It had once been two different stores located in the same building, but then Mr. Radowski had bought the building and knocked down the dividing wall. On the fun side were pens and pencil and paper and greeting cards and magazines and comics and paperbacks and candy. The other side was all boring hardware and small appliances. Mr. Radowski was on the phone when I came in, but then he was always on the phone when he worked. He could sell you a hammer or a pack of baseball cards, tell you a joke, ask about your family, complain about the weather, and still keep the guy on the other end of the line happy. This time, though, when he saw me come in, he turned away, wrapping the phone cord across his shoulder. I went through the store quickly and found everything Cross had wanted. I had to blow dust off the transistor radio box, but the batteries looked fresh. There was only one New York Times left. The headlines were so big, they were scary. U.S. imposes arms blockade on Cuba on finding of offensive missile sites. Kennedy ready for Soviet showdown. Ships must stop. President grave. Prepared to risk war. I set my purchases on the counter in front of Mr. Radowski. He cocked his head to one side, trapping the telephone receiver against his shoulder, and rang me up. The paper was on the bottom of the pile.
Since when do you read the Times, Ray? I just got the new Fantastic Four.
Maybe tomorrow.
All right, then. It comes to $12.47.
I gave him the $100 bill.
What is this, Ray?
He stared at it. And then at me. I had my story all ready.
It was a birthday gift from my grandma in Detroit. She said I could spend it on whatever I wanted, so I decided to treat myself. But I'm going to put the rest of it in the bank.
You're buying a radio? From me?
Well, you know, I thought maybe I should have one with me with all the stuff going on.
He didn't say anything for a moment. He just pulled a paper bag from under the counter and put my things into it. His shoulders were hunched. I thought maybe he felt guilty about overcharging for the radio.
You should be listening to music, Ray. You like Elvis? All kids like Elvis. Or maybe that color, the one who does the twist.
They're all right, I guess.
You're too young to be worrying about the news, you hear me? Those politicians. It's gonna be okay, Ray. You heard it from me.
Sure, Mr. Radowski. I was wondering, can I get $5 in change?
I could feel him watching me as I stuffed it all into my book bag. I was certain he'd call my mom, but he never did. Home was 3 miles up Cobbs Hill. I did it in 40 minutes. A record. I remember I started running when I saw the flashing lights. The police car had left skid marks on the gravel on our driveway. Mom burst out of the house as I came across the lawn.
Where were you? Oh my God, Ramey, I was worried sick.
She caught me up in her arms. She was about to smother me. I squirmed free.
I got off the bus in Ward's Hollow. What happened?
This the boy, ma'am?
The state trooper had taken his time catching up to her. He had almost the same hat as Scoutmaster Newell.
Yes. Oh, thank God, officer.
The trooper patted me on the head like I was a lost dog.
You had your mom worried, Ray.
Raimi, you should have told me.
Somebody tell me what happened.
A second trooper came from behind the house. We watched him approach.
No sign of any intruder.
He looked bored. I wanted to scream.
Intruder? He broke into the shelter. He knew my name.
There was no sign of forcible entry. Nothing disturbed that I could see.
I saw him exchange a glance with his partner.
He didn't have time. When I found him in the shelter, I ran back to the house and got your father's gun from the bedroom.
The thought of Mom with the .38 scared me. I had my shooting merit badge, but she didn't know a hammer from a trigger.
You didn't shoot him?
No, he had plenty of time to leave, but he was still there when I came back. That's when he said my name.
I had never been so mad at her before.
You never go out to the shelter.
She had that puzzled look she always gets at night.
I couldn't find my key. I had to use the one your father leaves over the breezeway door.
What did he say again, ma'am? The intruder?
He said, Mrs. Belmont, I present no danger to you. And I said, who are you? And then he came toward me, and I thought he said, Margaret, and I started firing.
You did shoot him?
Both troopers must have heard the panic in my voice.
You know something about this man, Ray?
No, I was at school all day, and then I stopped at Rudowski's.
I could feel my eyes burning. I was so embarrassed. I knew I was about to cry in front of them. Mom acted annoyed that the troopers had stopped paying attention to her.
I shot at him 3-4 times. I don't know. I must have missed because he just stood there staring at me. It seemed like forever. Then he walked past me and up the stairs like nothing had happened.
And he didn't say anything?
Not a word.
Well, it beats me. The guns have been fired 4 times, but there are no bullet holes in the shelter and no blood stains. You mind if I ask you a personal question, Mrs. Beaumont?
I suppose not.
Have you been drinking, ma'am?
Oh, that. No, well, I mean, after I called you, I did pour myself a little something just to steady my nerves. I was worried because my son was so late. And, Raimi, what's the matter?
I felt so small. The tears were pouring down my face. After the troopers left, I remember Mom baking brownies while I watched Superman. I wanted to go out and hunt for Cross, but it was already sunset, and there was no excuse I could come up with for wandering around in the dark. Besides, what was the point? He was gone, driven off by my mother. I'd had a chance to help a man from the future change history, maybe prevent World War III, and I'd blown it. My life was ashes. I wasn't hungry that night for brownies or spaghetti or anything. But Mom made that clucking noise when I pushed supper around the plate, so I ate a few bites just to shut her up. I was surprised at how easy it was to hate her. How good it felt. Of course, she was oblivious, but in the morning she would notice if I wasn't careful. After dinner, she watched the news, and I went upstairs to read. I wrapped a pillow around my head when she yelled at David Brinkley. I turned out the lights at 8:30, but I couldn't get to sleep. She went to her room a little after that.
Mr. Beaumont?
I must have dozed off, but when I heard his voice, I snapped awake immediately. I peered into the darkness.
Is that you, Mr. Cross? I bought the stuff you wanted.
The room filled with an awful stink, like when Mom drove with the parking brake on.
Mr. Beaumont, I am damaged.
I slipped out of bed, picked my way across the dark room, locked the door, and turned on the light.
Oh, jeez.
He slumped against my desk like a nightmare. I remember thinking then that Cross wasn't human, that maybe he wasn't even alive. His proportions were wrong. An ear, a shoulder, and both feet sagged like they had melted. Little wisps of steam or something curled off him. They were what smelled. His skin had gone all shiny and hard. So had his business suit. I'd wondered why he never took the suit off, and now I knew. His clothes were part of him. The middle fingers of his right hand beat spasmodically against his palm.
Mr. Beaumont, I calculate your chances at 10 to the 16 to
to one.
Chances of what? What happened to you?
You must listen, moused attentively, Mr. Beaumont. My decline is very bad for history. It is for you now to alter the timeline probabilities.
I don't understand.
Your government greatly overestimates the nuclear capability of the Soviet Union. If you originate a first strike, the United States will achieve overwhelming victory.
Does the president know this? We have to tell him.
John Kennedy will not welcome such information. If he starts this war, he will be responsible for the deaths of tens of millions, both Russians and Americans. But he does not grasp the future of the arms race. The war must happen now, because those who come after will build and build until they control arsenals which can destroy the world many times over. People are not capable of thinking for very long of such
fearsome weapons.
They tire of the idea of extinction, and they become numb to it. The build-up slows, but does not stop, and they congratulate themselves on having survived it. But there are still too many weapons, and they never go away. The third war comes as a surprise. The first war was called the one to end all wars. The third war is the only such war possible, Mr. Beaumont, because it ends everything. History stops in 2019. Do you understand? A year later, there is no life. All dead. The world, a hot, barren rock.
But you...
I am nothing. A construct. Mr. Beaumont, please. The chances are 10 to the 16 to 1. Do you know how improbable that is? But for the sake of those few precious timelines, we must continue. There is a man, a politician in New York. If he dies on Tuesday night, it will create the incident that forces Kennedy's hand.
Dies?
For days, I had been desperate for him to talk. Now, all I wanted was to run away.
You're gonna kill somebody?
The world will survive a third war that starts on Friday, October 22, 1962.
What about me? My parents? Do we survive?
I cannot access that timeline. I have no certain answer for you. Please, Mr. Beaumont, this politician will die of a heart attack in less than 3 years. He has made no great contribution to history, yet his assassination can save the world.
What do you want from me?
But I'd already guessed.
He will speak most eloquently at the United Nations on Friday evening. Afterward, he will have dinner with his friend, Ruth Fields. Around 10 o'clock, he will return to his residence at the Waldorf Towers, not the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, but the Towers. He will take the elevator to Suite 42A. He is the American ambassador to the United Nations. His name is Adlai Stevenson.
Stop it! Don't say anything else!
His breath was a cloud of acrid steam.
I have based my calculation of the timeline probabilities on 2 data points, Mr. Beaumont, which I discovered in your bomb shelter. The first is the .357 Magnum revolver located under a pallet of rice bags. I trust you know of this weapon?
Yes.
The second is the collection of magazines located under your cot. It would seem that you take an interest in what is to come, Mr. Baumont, and that may lend you the terrible courage you will need to divert this timeline from disaster. You should know that there is not just one future. There are an infinite number of futures in which all possibilities are expressed. An infinite number of Raymond Baumanns.
Mr. Cross, I can't.
Perhaps not, but I believe that another one of you can.
You don't understand.
I watched in horror as a boil swelled on the side of his face and popped, expelling an evil jet of yellow steam.
What the?
Oh, fuck!
That was the last thing he said. He slid to the floor, or maybe he was just a body at that point. More boils formed and burst. I opened all the windows in my room and got the fan down out of the closet. And still, I can't believe that the stink didn't wake Mom up. Over the course of the next few hours, he sort of vaporized. When it was over, there was a sticky, dark spot on the floor the size of my pillow. I moved the throw rug from one side of the room to the other to cover it up. I had nothing to prove that Cross existed, but a transistor radio, a couple of batteries, an earplug, and $87.53 in change. I might have done things differently if I hadn't had a day to think. I can't remember going to school on Wednesday, who I talked to, what I ate. I was feverishly trying to figure out what to do and how to do it. I had no place to go for answers. Not Miss Tui, not my parents, not the Bible or the Boy Scout handbook, certainly not Galaxy Magazine. Whatever I did had to come out of me. I watched the news with Mom that night. President Kennedy had brought our military to the highest possible state of alert. There were reports that some Russian ships had turned away from Cuba. Others continued on course. Dad called and said his trip was being cut short and that he would be home the next day. But that was too late. I hid behind the stone wall when the school bus came on Thursday morning. Mrs. Johnson honked a couple of times and then drove on. I set out for New Canaan, carrying my book bag. In it were the radio, the batteries, the coins, the map of New York, and the 357. I had the rest of Cross's money in my wallet. It took more than 5 hours to hike to the train station. I expected to be scared, but the whole time I felt light as air. I kept thinking of what Cross had said about the future, that I was just one of millions and millions of Raymond Beaumonts. Most of them were in school, diagramming sentences and watching Miss Tui bite her nails. I was the special one, walking into history. I was super. I caught the 2:38 train, changed in Stamford, and arrived at Grand Central just after 4. I had 6 hours. I bought myself a hot pretzel and a Coke and tried to decide where I should go. I couldn't just sit around the hotel lobby for all that time. I thought that would draw too much attention. I decided to go to the top of the Empire State Building. I took my time walking down Park Avenue and tried not to see all the ghosts I was about to make. In the lobby of the Empire State Building, I used Cross's change to call home.
Hello?
I hadn't expected Dad to answer. I would have hung up except that I knew I might never speak to him again.
Dad, this is Ray. I'm safe. Don't worry.
Ray, where are you?
I can't talk. I'm safe, but I won't be home tonight. Don't worry.
Ray, what's going on?
I'm sorry.
Ray!
I had to hang up.
I love you.
I could imagine the expression on Dad's face. How he would tell Mom what I'd said. Eventually, they would argue about it. He would shout. She would cry. As I rode the elevator up, I got mad at them. He shouldn't have picked up the phone. They should have protected me from Cross and the future he came from. I was in the 6th grade. I shouldn't have to have feelings like this. The observation platform was almost deserted. I walked completely around it, staring at the city stretching away from me in every direction. It was dusk. The buildings were shadows in the failing light. I didn't feel like Ray Beaumont anymore. He was my secret identity. Now I was the superhero Bomb Boy. I had the power of bringing nuclear war. Wherever I cast my terrible gaze, cars melted and people burst into flame. And I loved it. It was dark when I came down from the Empire State Building. I had a sausage pizza and a Coke on 47th Street. While I ate, I stuck the plug into my ear and listened to the radio. I searched for the news. One announcer said the debate was still going on in the Security Council. Our ambassador was questioning Ambassador Zorin. I stayed with that station for a while, hoping to hear his voice. I knew what he looked like, of course. I knew Adlai Stevenson had run for president a couple of times when I was just a baby, but I couldn't remember what he sounded like. He might talk to me, ask me what I was doing in his hotel. I wanted to be ready for that. I arrived at the Waldorf Towers around 9 o'clock. I picked a plush velvet chair that had a direct view of the elevator bank and sat there for about 10 minutes. Nobody seemed to care, but it was hard to sit still. Finally, I got up and went to the men's room. I took my book bag into the stall, closed the door, and got the .357 out. I aimed it at the toilet. The gun was heavy, and I could tell it would have a big kick. I probably ought to hold it with both hands. I put it back into my book bag and flushed. When I came out of the bathroom, I had stopped believing that I was going to shoot anyone, that I could. But I had to find out for Cross's sake. If I was really meant to save the world, then I had to be in the right place at the right time. I went back to my chair, checked my watch. It was 9:20. I started thinking of the one who would pull the trigger, the unlikely Ray. What would make the difference? Had he read some story in Galaxy that I had skipped? Was it a problem with Mom or Dad? Maybe he had spelled Enigma right. Maybe Cross had lived another 30 seconds in his timeline. Or maybe he was just the best that I could possibly be. I was so tired of it all. I must have walked 30 miles since morning, and I hadn't slept well in days. The lobby was warm. People laughed and murmured. Elevator doors dinged softly. I tried to stay up to face history, but I couldn't. I was Raymond Beaumont, but I was just a 12-year-old kid. I remember the doorman waking me up at 11 o'clock. Dad drove all the way into the city that night to get me.
Oh my God.
When we got home, Mom was already in the shelter. Only the Third War didn't start that night, or the next. I lost television privileges for a month. For most people my age, the most traumatic memory of growing up came on November 22nd, 1963. But the date I remember is July 14th, 1965, when Adlai Stevenson dropped dead of a heart attack in London. I've tried to do what I can to make up for what I didn't do that night. I've worked for the cause wherever I could find it. I belong to C&D and SANE and the Friends of the Earth, and was active in the nuclear freeze movement. I think the Green Party is the only political organization worth your vote. I don't know if any of it will change Cross's awful probabilities. Maybe we'll survive in a few more timelines. When I was a kid, I didn't mind being lonely. Now, it's hard knowing what I know. Oh, I have lots of friends, all of them wonderful people. But people who know me say that there's a part of myself that I always keep hidden. They're right. I don't think I'll ever be able to tell anyone about what happened with Cross. What I didn't do that night. It wouldn't be fair to them. Besides, whatever happens, chances are very good that it's my fault.
All right, so that's the story. What did you think of the story, Mona?
I thought it was interesting from like a historical perspective with the different perspective on all that. And are we screwed next year in 2019?
We don't know if the story is on plan. Because it was written in, what, 99?
Mm-hmm.
We could be screwed. It would be a surprise, although it's a little bit less of a surprise given our president. This reminds me of what you could call an internet hoax. There's this guy named John Teeter. This guy shows up in some internet chat room in like late 1999, early 2000. And he's like, I'm a time traveler from the year 2030. And he outlines this history of the world and what had happened. Because he left back to his time like in early 2001. And he had like specific things that happened in like 2005 and 2010. And those things didn't happen. Didn't predict 9/11, but he was like, before he left, oh, it's this sort of many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. There's an infinite number of universes and probabilities and possibilities. That's the same thing with this story. In a sense, it could be that we have the end of the world in 2019, or it could be not. And that's a huge burden to place on a 12-year-old. Would you do it? That would you have shot
the UN ambassador?
The random politician.
I don't think I'd have the guts to do it.
I don't know if I would either.
I'm not a killer. Based on the interactions that he had with Mr. Cross, if I was going to consider doing something that drastic because a future robot told me to, I would need to have a lot more information, a lot more assurances that I was doing the right thing. I feel like my 12-year-old self would think that the whole situation was too insane. Even if I knew it was going to save the world, I don't think I could do it.
You're saying that we don't trade lives?
That's true. I don't trade lives. I'm not shooting the ambassador to save the world.
I have a feeling for both of us, it has less to do with whether we're like utilitarian enough and whether it's just like, can we kill somebody?
Yeah.
Like, can we actually do it? Even if
I don't think I could actually do it. When I think about situations where I could murder someone, the only situations that are feasible for me to actually do it are in self-defense.
Mm.
I don't think there would be any circumstance where I would be able to go up to somebody and kill them.
Yeah, especially if I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting because like this time-traveling robot who goes back in time to assassinate, does that sound like a franchise you're familiar with that maybe rhymes with Schnurbinator?
Schnurbinator.
But he's like, oh, but there's other timelines, so I'm just trying to make it so that some of these timelines make it work. But wouldn't there already be some timelines that don't have nuclear war in 2019? So I think we're safe, Mr. Cross, globally in the multiverse spectrum of it all. All right, well, that's it. That's our discussion. Music is courtesy of Purple Planet, as well as Looperman. Props also go out to the YouTube channels Footage Farm and Throwback, which had the relevant Kennedy speech and commercial audio needed for the story. You can find more info in the show notes. You can also follow the podcast on Facebook and Twitter at Skiffly Podcast. And you can find me on Instagram at AYUSOS1. And you can drop me some comments on any of those. You can find Mona on Instagram at So Against the Grain. You can also find So Against the Grain on Etsy, where Mona makes custom science fiction dresses, shirts, ties, ascots, skirts, and
cat overalls
and pajama pants, along with other versions of these types of clothing that are not science fiction themed. You can help out the podcast by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and Google Play and Podomatic and Stitcher and maybe Yelp. I don't know. If you rate the podcast, that'll let other people know about this wonderful science fiction literature audiobook podcast. And then you can help people find it, and then it will grow. Thank you, Mona, for helping out.
Ba, ba, ba.
And thank you, listeners, for listening. And be sure to tune in next time for episode 18.